The following lecture was delivered at the 17th Annual National Jewish Retreat in Palm Desert, California, a project of the Rohr Jewish Learning Institute. We hope you enjoy it. We encourage you to visit jretreat.com for information on upcoming retreats. Rabbi Moshe Krasniansky now presents his lecture, The Talmudic Sages and the Philosophers.
We don't find often rabbis debating with secular or other religious scholars. It's not a common event that happens. And it's interesting because in Judaism, debate, discussion is encouraged. You open up the Talmud, and it's all about debate and discussion. Every page, they're arguing you, and you can imagine that they are with such passion and such strong opinions. We find actually many sages that they were constantly arguing with each other. They were also best friends, but they were always arguing with each other. And why is it that we don't find that the rabbis would spend their time debating other religions to prove that Judaism is correct? And especially that we are charged to be a Or LaGoyim, we're charged to be a light unto the nations, to bring the message of Torah and Judaism to the world. But it's not something we've seen. And actually, if you look a little bit into history, you will find that there were debates between the Christians and the Jews. But most of those debates were forced upon the Jews. It was a time when we were living under the rule of governments that were either overseen by the church or totally loyal to the church. And they forced Jewish people, their rabbis, to debate them to try to prove to their masses that they were superior over Judaism. And as we know, whether the rabbi was right or wrong, they always declared them wrong, and they were the victors. One of the most famous debaters was Nachmanides, the Ramban in Spain, who was promised by the king, who had a lot of respect for Nachmanides, that he would protect him, he'd be honest and fair. And the truth is, Nachmanides won the debate, and yet the king could not guarantee his safety after he won the debate. And he had to, at an old age, make the long pilgrimage to Israel. So debates was not something that was part of, and like today, part of the regular curriculum of rabbis, sages. But yet, in the Talmud and other holy books from that era of the rabbis, during the times of the Second Temple, post-destruction, we find discussions and some debates. Today we're going to talk about one of them, about Judaism against other religions, or other philosophies. And the fact that these were transcribed in the Talmud for us to study, it's obvious that there is something for us to learn from this and to understand. And today we're going to try to understand what caused the elders, the philosophers of the other nations, and often people who were controlling us. You know, we lived under the rule and oppression, the Greeks, the Romans. And why did they seek out to have discussions? It was always their initiative, and to debate with us when they ruled us. Not only they ruled us, they oppressed us. They controlled our movements. They disallowed the Jews to partake of many of the mitzvahs, commandments. What drove them? What was missing from their ruling place to want to engage? So one thing that was missing was that they never understood. How is it that the Jewish people, even when we were oppressed, even when it was clear that we were the inferior people in their eyes, we never felt inferior. We always felt superior. We always felt that we carried the truth. We were maybe knocked down, but never felt knocked out. And they couldn't understand, how can it be when all your freedoms are taken away? You can't even study Torah, which many times they disallowed. And yet we still felt that the truth was with us. We were the ones that were on the right side of history. So initially, the first discussions that we find by the Greeks was actually in a very friendly manner. And we'll read, made it textual because it will help us understand the richness of what's going on. So if we're on page 2, I'm just going to read the English. We're going to talk about Alexander the Great. We refer to him as Alexander Mogdan. So Alexander the Great, as we know, conquered the world, the first great conqueror of the world. And in the process of conquering the world, he went from Europe all the way to India. He conquered Israel as well. At some point, there was a group of people in Israel who did not like the rabbinical Judaism and the leadership of the Jews, and they tried to convince Alexander that the Jews are really a danger to him, and he should get rid of their symbol, the temple, and really control the Jewish people. So Alexander made a trip to Israel. The Jews heard about this, led by Shimon HaTzadik, who was then the high priest. They decided that they were going to meet Alexander and plea on behalf of the Jews, don't touch our religion, don't touch the temple, the holy temple. So Shimon HaTzadik donned the clothes of the high priest, something you're not supposed to wear outside of the temple, but it was a special moment. And he led a delegation that went to greet Alexander. They heard where he's coming from. As soon as he would enter Israel, they would greet him. And something surprising happened. They see Alexander approaching, and they're all in their horses, wearing the high priest. And Alexander, as he approaches, he stops leading his army. He led his army. He was the most powerful leader and person. And Alexander got off his high horse and bowed down towards Shimon HaTzadik. His people were shocked. Alexander the Great never bowed down to anybody. Everybody bowed down to him. What was going on? And they asked him, and he said that this is a special face. This holy face is one that I see in various dreams I've had in times when I wasn't sure if I'll be victorious or I should go to war. And in my dream, I saw this face, gave me assurance. He's a holy man. And at that point, the rabbis realized this was their opportunity, and they told him that we're happy to be your subjects, but leave Judaism alone. And Alexander spent some time, having heard about the Jews being thinking people, logical people, people of the book, to discuss with them their philosophy of life, how they view life. We know Alexander was a student of Aristotle, according to many. So, we'll read a little bit from text 1. So, with regard to the position of the sun, the Gemara relates that Alexander of Macedon asked the elders of Negev about 10 matters. We're not going to read all 10. We're just going to touch one of them. He said to them, I'm going to read the bold. He said to them, were the heavens created first or the earth? So, this is a question he asked. What was created first, heaven or earth? They said, the rabbis answered, heavens were created first, as it stated, in the beginning God created the heaven and the earth. So Alexander the Great had a moment to meet with the rabbis, and what was his question? Why was this such an important question to ask them? Is it, what difference does it make in life if heaven was created first or earth? What was he trying to get at? So Alexander was coming based on the philosophy of the time, where the question is, there is a heaven and an earth. There is a heaven, a God somewhere out there created the world. But there's also an earth, our earth, the earth that we control, the earth that we are here to develop and agree. So many of the many sciences and other philosophies were developed where they learned to master, to control and manipulate earth. So his question was, which one was created first? Which is more important? Is heaven where it's all about, or is it at earth? Which one is more prominent? To the Greeks, earth, mankind, our abilities, everything about Greek philosophy and the Greek way was about the power of earth, our control of earth. So the rabbis answered, heaven. To the Jewish people, it all began with heaven, and heaven guides earth and our earthly living. Then he said to them, was light created first or darkness? And they answered him, this matter has no solution. So the Gemara asked, the Talmud asks, but let them say to him, darkness was created first. Why did they say there's no solution? The same way they answered that heaven is first, they should have said darkness was created first, as it is written in the same story in Genesis. Now the earth was unformed and void, and darkness was upon the face of the earth. And only then does it say, and God said, let there be light, and there was light. So obviously darkness came before light. So why wouldn't they answer the question? So the Talmud continues and answers that the elders maintained that if we answer this question, lest he come to ask what is above the firmament, what's below the earth, what was before creation, what will be after the end of the world. At some point they said, this conversation is going to go nowhere because we're not going to be talking in the same language, and what's the point of continuing to engage? What was his question? What is first, light or darkness? What was he getting at? Does it really make a difference what comes first? Yes, as Jews, the night comes before the day. That's how we count our days. In the secular world, in the general world, day comes before night. What was he getting at? See, here also, this was an existential question, and later we're going to see a little bit more about it even, of what night and day, or light and darkness, represents. Day, light, represents goodness, kindness, brightness, giving, sharing. Night, negativity, evil. To the Greeks, evil is something very real. It's something very powerful. It stands on its own. Actually, in their eyes, it may even be more powerful than the power of goodness, because evil prevails in this world, as we all see how negativity and evil is so much stronger than the power of goodness and kindness and light. So he was asking them, which is more powerful? What comes first, light or darkness? Is darkness more powerful, or is the power of goodness more powerful? But here the rabbis already took a step back, because we don't see darkness, negativity, or evil in the same way. A little later we'll get more into it. We don't see it as being ultimately evil and bad and on the wrong side. We see it in a different way, which we'll get to later. So here you find Alexander, in a very friendly way, was trying to understand how the Jewish people think. They came from Europe, here they come to the Middle East. The only people that are people of the book, what are they like? Obviously, he met that they're very different. And initially, the Jewish people got along well. But as we know, it happened with the Greeks and the Romans. At some point, the relationship soured. Because as logical and as smart and as open they were for discussion, the Jewish people had a very different way of seeing things and had a commitment to something that they couldn't relate to. But as we'll read in the next piece, even at times when the Jewish people were oppressed, we're going to read about Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva was one of the 10 martyrs who, after the second revolt, the temple was destroyed, then the Bar Kokhba revolt for 9 years, and the Romans really destroyed the Jews even worse, and they became much more oppressive and much more difficult with the Jews. And in the aftermath of that, they chose 10 martyrs. We read about it on Yom Kippur and Tisha B'Av. And each one of the greatest rabbis was chosen to die a cruel but different death. One of the most well-known is Rabbi Akiva, and the great sage Rabbi Akiva. And Rabbi Akiva, according to many, his executor, the one who was Turnus Rufus, or Russia, the evil Turnus Rufus. And we're going to read in the Talmud a discussion of someone who ruled that Rabbi Akiva will be punished with death alone. What space does Rabbi Akiva take up in the mind of Turnus Rufus? He has all the control. He's going to get rid of Rabbi Akiva. He'll get rid of his legacy. He'll get rid of his following. They forced the students to watch him being killed. I mean, so what was there to have any discussion? In the States, when they put someone on death row, do they start meeting with them to know what he's thinking? What he's thinking about? Maybe the psychologist and others. But what is? But yet, this is what happened. This is a discussion that ensued between someone who was about to execute at some point. Rabbi Akiva was talking to Rabbi Akiva, and he said like this. So, in text number 2. So, and this is the question that Turnus Rufus the wicked asked Rabbi Akiva. If your God loves the poor, for what does he not support them himself? Meaning, obviously it's understood, why are there poor people in this world? If God loves, like you say, everyone, let him take care of everyone. So Rabbi Akiva said to him, so that through them and the charity we give to poor people, we will be safe from the judgment of Gehenna. So meaning God gives the opportunity for kindness to happen. And when people are kind, so when people don't have, and then there are people who do have, and those who have help those who don't have, so all of a sudden you're doing acts of kindness, and this is a mitzvah, this is a good deed, and even though we may fail and falter and sin and do things, but this saves us, and we know especially charity saves us in a great way from being punished. So then, Turnus Rufus turns to Rabbi Akiva and says, wait 1 second. So in the second paragraph on page 5, he said to Rabbi Akiva, on the contrary, it is this which condemns you to Gehenna. And he begins to illustrate with a parable. So he said, what is this matter comparable? It's comparable to a king of flesh and blood who was angry with his slave and put him into prison in order that he should not be fed or given to drink. And one person went ahead and fed him and gave him to drink. If the king heard about this, would he not be angry with that person? And you, after all, are called slaves, as it is stated, for the children of Israel are slaves to me. See, he said in his thinking, on the contrary, if God condemns someone to be poor and you go behind God's back and help them, you are getting in the way of God's way of running the world. So you should be punished. Not that this is going to save you from purgatory and from hell. This should be a punishment for going out of the way and helping. So Rabbi Akiva answered him. Rabbi Akiva said, in the last paragraph, I will illustrate to you with a different parable. To what this matter is comparable, to a king of flesh and blood who was angry with his son and put him in prison in order that he should not be fed or given to drink. But one person went ahead and fed him and gave him to drink. If the king heard about this, would he not react by sending this person a gift? And we are called sons, that it is written, you're the sons of Lord your God. So Rabbi Akiva said, no, we are the children of God. And even if someone is poor, or someone would be sent to prison, or someone's condemned to a certain extent, as a child, wouldn't the parent be happy if someone cared about their child? For sure. So then the discussion ends, and then we'll explain what's going on. So then Turnus Rufus said to him, you are called sons, you're called slaves. When you fulfill the will of the omnipresent God, you're called sons. When you do not fulfill the will of God, you're called slaves. And since you do not fulfill the will of the omnipresent, so therefore you are slaves and you're not children. So Rabbi Akiva answered him, the verse states, is it not to share your bread with the hungry, and that you shall bring the poor that are cast out to your house? When do we bring the poor that are cast out into our houses? Now, when we're under the Romans, and the verse states, is it not to share your bread with the hungry? So meaning that Rabbi Akiva answered, we're always God's children. What is really going on here? What bothered Turnus Rufus when he's about to kill this man? What does he care about the poor? So the truth is, I think we can say that he's talking to Rabbi Akiva about himself. He says, Rabbi Akiva, you have been condemned to die. God destroyed your temple. He destroyed the Bar Kokhba revolt and the remaining bastion of Jewish life in Israel. You've been condemned to be tortured and killed. Where's your God? How come God is not here to save you? Isn't it meaning that you guys are down and out, that you're cast out by God? He couldn't understand how Rabbi Akiva could face him as the great Rabbi Akiva with the same sense of conviction, pride, commitment, not buckle. How can that be? Couldn't understand. Because in the eyes of the Romans, like the Greeks, it was all about physical power. Whoever is on top is the right one. And if you're not on top, you're on the bottom, that means you're on the wrong side. And Rabbi Akiva so clearly explained to him that we as Jews believe we're always the children of God. God always loves us. And even if someone is poor, even if I'm condemned to death, it does not take away from God's love of myself and my love of God. We know Rabbi Akiva, at the moment of his death, when the comb, hot combs that they were combing his body, reached the place where you put on the head tefillin, and his students couldn't handle it anymore. How could someone who learned and taught so much Torah could be condemned to such a death? And he said, this is my greatest moment to be able to declare to God that I've not veered one iota from believing in you and believing in your goodness and in your kindness and your correctness. This was what Rabbi Akiva was saying, because even though you're killing my body, you don't control my soul. And we know in our time, forward to our times, the previous Lubavitcher Rebbe, who stood up to the powerful communist government, the KGB and the Jewish section of the KGB, who worked harder than any other section to uproot any vestige of Jewish life, and initially arrested to be condemned to death, miraculously and with the involvement of many people around the world, they changed the conviction of death to exile. And on his way to the train to go to exile, many Hasidim came to see him off. They didn't see him since he was arrested. And defiantly, he gave an incredible talk, watched by all the KGB and the Vesekse, the Jewish section. And what he basically said was that our enemies can only control our body, not our soul. They imprison me, they exile me, but they don't control our soul and spirit. We are Jews, remain committed, keep the faith, pass it on to your children. And this is what Rabbi Akiva was telling Turnus Rufus. You maybe have physical control, but this doesn't to do with who we are really, our soul, the fact that we're children of God. So these were questions that they dealt with, but not debates. There is, in the Talmud, a story, and that's what we're going to delve into now, Rabbi Yeshua ben Chananya, Yeshua the son of Chananya. So the Romans requested that the Jewish people debate with their philosophers, specifically this elders of Athens. Even in the Roman Empire, the great Greek philosophers, elders, great thinkers who were holed up in some hidden place. You know, like today everyone goes to Davos, Switzerland, where they planned the world. These were the people who were deciding what's right, what's wrong. But they were not the rich people, they were the thinkers, the philosophers. And it was Rabbi Yeshua ben Chananya was chosen to go, eventually was a leader of the Jewish people, chosen to go into debate with these people. And the Talmud brings down many questions, the process of how he got there and many questions that were asked. And I want to read a little bit. We're not, in the text, we're not going through everything, because then it would never end, but just to bring you some samples to understand what was going on. So I want to read how it came about that he ended up going to debate, how he found where they were hidden, and then we're going to talk about some of the questions that they asked him. So in text number 3, page number 4, I think it is. So the emperor said to Rabbi Yeshua ben Chananya, he said, I wish to see your God. So he answered, you cannot see him. You want to see God, you can't see him. So the emperor said, truly? But I wish to see him. You have to show him to me. I mean, if you have a God you're so committed to every day, you wake up in the morning, you go to sleep at night, you're following his commandments, you're observing, you keep Shabbos, you kosher, tefillin, all these, and you don't even know where God is, you can't see him. I want to see him. So Rabbi Yeshua went and stood, the emperor facing the sun in the season of Tammuz, very, very hot season, and he said to him, look at the sun, look up at the sun. The emperor said, I can't. It's too powerful, too strong. So Rabbi Yeshua said to him, so imagine, with regard to the sun, which is only one of the servants that stand before the Holy One, blessed be he, you say, I cannot look at it. Is it not all the more so with regard to the divine presence itself? If you can't see the sun, one of God's creations, you want to see God? So what's the question? I want to see God. No, you can't see God. What is it, a game they're playing? What's driving this discussion? We'll explain it soon. Let's go to text 4. So now, he asked him another question. So with regard to the gestation time of a snake, the Gemara relates that the Roman emperor said to Rabbi Yeshua, the son of Chananya, in the case of a snake, after how long of gestation does it give birth? How long is the pregnancy period? So Rabbi Yeshua Chananya said to him, 7 years. The emperor said, but the elders, the sages of the school of Athens bred snakes, and they gave birth after 3 years. So Rabbi Yeshua replied, listen with the confidence, that these snakes were already pregnant from beforehand for 4 years. It takes 7 years. Your facts, don't let it get in the way. The emperor asked, but they engaged in intercourse, meaning, because his opinion was that animals only engage to give birth. So Rabbi Yeshua responded, snakes also engage in intercourse like people. Then the emperor, so that was one discussion, gestation of snakes. I mean, is that really what bothered him? How long is the gestation period of pregnancy? And that's what he called the leading rabbi of the time to understand what our opinion is, how long a snake is pregnant till it gives birth. I mean, come on, this is, and we're going to see, some of the arguments or the debates were very cryptic. You know, what is really going on? So then the emperor said to him, how can you disagree with the sages of Athens? These are the smartest people in the world, the greatest philosophers. They sit and think all day long. Aren't they wise? Rabbi Shor responded, we are wiser than they. The emperor said, if you're wiser, go defeat them and bring them to me. So Rabbi Shor said, how many are there? And the emperor answered, 60 men. So then, the last paragraph, Rabbi Shor, when Hanani said to him, construct a ship that has 60 rooms for me, and each room should have 60 mattresses in it, meaning when I win them, I want to bring them into that ship, and he constructed it, and then he set out for Athens. But they didn't tell him where the elders are, always part of the way of, let's see how smart you are. So he started to look, where are these elders hanging out? Where are they hiding? So when he arrived there to Rome, so he entered a butcher shop and he found a certain man, the butcher, flaying an animal. So Rabbi Shua said to him, is your head for sale? So the butcher said, yes, it is. So Rabbi Shua said, for how much? So he said, for half a dinar. So Rabbi Shua gave him the money. That's the next page. After Rabbi Shua paid the butcher, he said to him, did I say to you that I want the head of an animal? I want your head. And you must keep your word. I asked you for a head. You told me a price. I paid you. I need your head. So Rabbi Shua said to him, if you wish for me to let you go from your word that you're going to sell me a head, show me the entrance to the school of the sages of Athens. And the butcher said to him, I'm afraid as they kill anyone who shows the location. So Rabbi Shua said, carry a bundle of reeds, and when you arrive to their place, stand it up like one who is resting, and then I'll recognize where it is. Again, what's Rabbi Shua Hananya with the butcher? You know, this makes Shakespeare sound correct, that Jewish people, money is everything, they want the head, they're cruel, they don't care, a real pound of flesh. What is going on? A head of an animal, a head of a person, like what's happening? Okay, he finds the place of Athens. It's a long story about how he got in, but that's not for now. And the next paragraph reads, so the sages of Athens said to him, in the case of a certain man who goes and asks to marry a woman and her family does not give her to him, why would he see fit to go to a family that's greater than the first? Meaning if you tried your luck to get a good marriage mate and you didn't succeed in getting someone of quality, do you then go to get better quality? Usually go down, right? If you didn't get this quality, at least I'll take. So Rabbi Shua took a peg, stuck it in the lower part of the wall, but it didn't go in. Then he stuck it at the upper part of the wall, and it went in. And he said to them, in this case too, when he goes to a more distinguished family than the first, perhaps he will find the girl destined for him. What kind of story is this about a marrying? What is going on? So I want to give you a little bit of a background. If you heard, remember we mentioned the elders of Athens. How many people were the elders of Athens? 60 people. The greatest body of the Jewish people that developed Jewish law, that dealt in all areas of Jewish law, was the Sanhedrin. How many people were on the Sanhedrin? 70 people on the Sanhedrin. 60 and 70. What else is seven? The menorah in the temple had seven branches. Our menorahs, Hanukkah is 8 plus a shamash, 7 branches. Days of the week, 7 days of the week. 6 days a week we work, on the seventh day we rest. Is it all just coincidence? Obviously nothing is coincidence. There's a lot of meaning behind this. 6 represents the physical dimensions of everything here on earth. Everything here has 6 sides to it, 6 dimensions, top and bottom and 4 sides. Everything has 6 dimensions. The philosophers, secular, religious, all the thinkers of the world, their only way of trying to grasp and to understand this world is through the six dimensions that exist. And we see it a lot in science. Anytime they want to understand something, they have to be able to hold on to something that could be very clearly, it's tangible in some way, you can measure it, you can look at it in different angles, but it's something that's measurable in some way. That's how they understand the world that we are put in. How do humans understand this world? That's the only way to understand the world, is to look at the world and understand what's going on. So you have to feel and hold to understand what's going on. But there's a seventh dimension. And that is that at the core of all six dimensions, there's a core, there's a center. God is the seventh dimension. God is at the center. It all came from somewhere. It wasn't there always. It didn't just exist. It was brought by God and maintained by God. God created these dimensions, but they never lose focus of the core of where they come from. They never go out of line of the core of who created them and why they were created. The seventh dimension is what the Jewish people have. Shabbos. 6 days a week, we're part of the world. Shabbos is a day we do the opposite of what anyone in the world does. We're not productive, we're not active, we take a step back. Shabbos is the godly dimension. Because when we have Shabbos, it infuses the rest of the week with the ability to interact with the six dimensions in the proper way and utilize it for their true purpose and connect them to the core at every level. You know that the Jewish people suffered under the Greeks and the Romans often for keeping Shabbos. They couldn't understand, how can a person live in this world and not interact with the world and be productive? Lazy. That's what they called us, lazy people. Because for us, there was that seventh dimension, but they can't relate to this dimension. Even the menorah, six branches, but three on each side faced the middle branch. All six were facing the middle branch because they took their guidance from the middle branch. 60 elders of Athens, 70 Sanhedrin. It played itself through in all ways. So there's a fascinating story with Ptolemy. I don't know how many of you heard of Ptolemy HaMelech or Ptolemy, the first one who had the Torah translated. So Ptolemy, who had the Torah translated into Greek, and Ptolemy took 70, the Septuagint it's called. He took 70 of the greatest sages of the Jewish people, and he brought them to Egypt. Ptolemy was very much into study, but he wanted to make sure when the Torah is translated, they give the truth, and he separated the 70 rabbis and had them translate. And God made a miracle, and they all translated exactly the same, and even made 13 changes that were all exactly the same. One of the changes was the first three words of the Torah. Bereshis bara Elokim. If you translate literally, it means in the beginning, created God. But they translate into Greek, God created in the beginning. Now, if you take the words God created in the beginning and translate it back into Hebrew, it's Elokim bara Bereshit. Why did they do it? Because they thought, in any area, they thought that the Greeks would be able to take their words and construe it in a way that to say it supports idols and various gods. So in the beginning could be a god who created another god. But it's interesting, according to the Greek way, Elokim bara Bereshit, God created in the beginning. Now, there's a big discussion. Bereshit, the first letter of the Torah is a bet, beis. And there's a discussion, why does the Torah begin with the letter beis? Why not with the letter aleph, the first letter of the Hebrew alphabet? God should respect, because you know the letters of the alphabet is not just letters for, it's building blocks, numerical values, the shapes. So we talk about the bet is bracha, is blessing. Aleph stands for arur, curse. So God wanted to start the Torah with blessing. There are many questions on this because there are many good words that start with bet and many negative words that start with aleph. But what's interesting is that the Greeks' Torah, the first translation of the Torah, starts with an aleph. So how is it that their Torah starts with an aleph in the translation R, it starts with the bet? So the answer is, we have a short time, so I want to get, the answer is that there are two dimensions to Torah. One dimension of Torah is wisdom. Torah is wisdom. It's the greatest book of wisdom in the world. And you know what? Even the other religions would study Torah. The Christians would study Torah in the original Hebrew and Aramaic. It's the greatest wisdom. And that's available for everyone. Anyone who opens up the Torah can find the great wisdom in Torah. But there's another dimension to Torah. And in Hebrew, Aleph is one and Bet is two. There's another dimension to Torah. That is that it's God's Torah, it's God's wisdom. When we study Torah, we're infused with a godly energy that takes us way above our logic and human logic and understanding. It connects us to something much more powerful, much more absolute, much more clear than the limited human capacity. For a Jew, Torah has that second dimension, that core, that seven. For the non-Jews, they can have all the wisdom, but they don't connect to that. They can't see the world beyond the nature of world as we see it. And this was at the core of many of the debates that they had, is that they looked at what they see in the world and, you know, gestation. What's gestation? Gestation is the process of creating something. To them, this is nature. There's a nature of gestation, how it has to happen. And no animal takes longer than 3 years. But the snake was the cause of the first sin. God punished the snake. God changed the gestation of the snake because God ultimately is in control of the world at all times. And whatever happens, even today, God controls. They couldn't understand. Where is this wisdom coming from? But they put them in a lab. They tested it. There's no question that that happened 4 years before then. The head of an animal. What's the significance of the head of an animal? It wasn't Shylock. To this wise person, they called him a butcher, but this wise person, he looked at Rabbi Yeshua and said, what are you going to debate with these elders? They're smarter than you. They're 60 elders. They've been studying philosophy and hundreds of years going on already. They understand the deepest things. And there are things that we, even Maimonides mentions various things in his laws of the new moon, to see the birth of the new moon and other things. He quotes from many wisdoms from other people, not philosophical. So how is it that you're coming to debate? How do you believe you're superior? And their whole way was that at the end of the day, we human beings, we're like animals. You know, Aristotle once was seen doing an immoral act. So they asked him, what's going on? You're this great philosopher. So he said, no, I'm not Aristotle. Meaning, my head is Aristotle, but my body, I'm a human being. I have temptations, desires. I want to fulfill them. So this is to them, we are just a head above an animal. A human being is a head above an animal. So what are you any better than us? We are better. We're more developed. We have this great schools of scholars. So Rabbi Yeshua said, we're the head of a human being. A human being is not an animal. We can live our life above, rising above our temptations. We can control them. We can change who we are and our nature and et cetera, et cetera. We're a different type of people. Marriage. God went to all the nations of the world to ask if they want the Torah. They said no. So why does God go to the Jewish people? We're just slaves. But the Jewish people, the peg fits in. Because we live life on a different dimension. We believe in God. We believe, and that's where it starts, that there is a God in this world. And that's where the logic lies, and everything else follows. So I'm not going to read inside. We only have a few minutes. Then they brought about an egg. They brought two eggs. And they said, you can look inside, they said, this egg comes from a white chicken or a black chicken. So Rabbi Shulchan Aruch Hananya answered, he brought cheese from two goats. He says, white cheese comes from a black or a white goat. Well, eggs, goats. So in short, this is very fascinating. An egg takes 21 days to hatch. So the sages of Athens said, there are two 21-day periods in the Jewish calendar. One 21-day period has existed for a long time, from Rosh Hashanah till the end of the holiday season, Hashana Rabbah, 21 days. Great time for the Jewish people. Holidays, reigning goddess, king, forgiveness. But there's another 21-day period that happened not long before then, the destruction of the Second Temple, from the 17th of Tammuz to the 9th of Av, a 21-day period of terrible tragedies for the Jewish people. The temple lost, many people killed. So they said, this egg that comes from the black cancels the egg that comes from the white. Yes, at one time the Jewish people, like every empire, had its great days, but it's over. The Jewish people are gone. It's black. So he brought the goats. You know, Yom Kippur, we bring two goats to the temple. Identical. One is chosen to go and be brought as a sacrifice on the altar, and the other one is chosen to be sent off a cliff outside Jerusalem. Now, you would think the one chosen to be the sacrifice, this is the honorable one. The other one is like sent out, Lazazel. That's in Hebrew, they still say, Lazazel, you know, get out of here. But they used to tie a ribbon around the goat, a red ribbon, and when they threw him off the cliff, if the ribbon turned white, they knew the Jews were forgiven. What does this mean? That in the Jewish view, darkness, sin, evil is not a permanent situation. In the Jewish view, that God put all different types of things in this world, and the evil and the negative is there to be transformed, to make us stronger, to allow us to turn darkness into light. Sin is there to do teshuvah, to repent and become a much stronger, more committed, and more connected person to God, to overcome your challenges and your shortcomings. There is no real black egg or black chicken that remained. It all becomes white. They couldn't relate to it. To them, evil remained something totally separate. I just want to finish off. We're short on time. Why Rabbi Yeshua, the son of Hananya? This was a very dangerous mission to go and to debate and argue. Why Rabbi Yeshua, the son of Hananya? This is something we told about him, and it's in here in the text. You can see it. Rabbi Yeshua, the son of Hananya, was a student of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, the great leader of the Jewish people. And Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai talked about his five greatest students, and he said their qualities. When it came to Rabbi Yeshua ben Hananya, he said, the quality of Rabbi Yeshua, the son of Hananya, is Ashrei Yoladato. Blessed is the one who gave birth to him. So all the other four, their qualities were about their own, their genius, their ability, their observance, their level of God-fearing. What do you mean? It's a blessed his mother. What does it have to do with him? Why his mother? Because from when he was born, she would bring him into the place of learning. So he should hear Torah. From even as a baby, she hear the words of Torah ringing in his ears. So what kind of greatness is this? But this is the true greatness. Because the greatness of the Jewish people is that we are tuned in to that dimension that this is God's wisdom, that this world is all about God. Everything in this world that leads to one road, and that is God. And that is something that's beyond logic. It's not about who he was. It's who he was born into, how he was born. This is the greatness of Rabbi Yeshua, son of Hananya. But at the same time, Rabbi Yeshua ben Hananya, there's a great story I put in here where there was an argument between the rabbis, Rabbi Eliezer, and many of the rabbis. Rabbi Eliezer, who was a great, great man, a great tzaddik, he was one against the many, and he wanted to win the debate. And he started to call forth miracles to happen to prove that his opinion is right about a certain oven, if it's pure or impure, could become pure or impure or not. And at some point he made a voice from heaven come out and say, that Rabbi Eliezer is correct, and Rabbi Shua ben Hananya was the leader of the Jewish people at the time, and he stood up, and he said, we don't listen to voices from heaven or these miracles, and they were real miracles, you can read it in here. God, when he gave us the Torah, he said, the Torah belongs to you, and you follow the majority. Now that takes a lot of guts, to hear a voice from heaven, and then to say, we're not gonna listen. He wasn't defying God, but this is the truth about who the rabbis were. They weren't just thinkers, philosophers, smart people. On one hand, they realized that God and Torah is rooted beyond any logic that we have. But at the same time, they were committed to understanding it as much as they could and be able to even to explain it to their detractors, to their enemies. And when they finished, the enemies always knew they were right. And though they may have killed Rabbi Akiva and many others, they never felt victorious because they knew that the Jewish people were carrying something they could never connect to. Thank you very much.
Please visit myjli.com to learn more about JLI's multiple educational offerings.